We beseech you, help us lift this great emotional burden running somewhere inside the burgeoning residue of our unfinished memories. Perhaps with your divine guidance, we may clean up a few unfinished desires. I'm not just talking about the dirty deeds involving Kleenex and the stack of unclean magazine that you, oh good lord, you haven't told our family and friends about, but the mini-malls that you have so generously provided, the holy swipe of your great instrument, commonly known as MasterCard, and the sense that voting for a man named Scott Brown will permit us to register a protest in a system where we have very little say. But you, oh Lord, you have the greatest say of all. And for that, I submit myself prostrate before your imposing premonitory powers.
Okay, so I'm here with Gail Godwin, who is most recently the author of Unfinished Desires. Gail, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
First off, I wanted to ask about we could start with a career question. A mother and two daughters, you have this very interesting, subtle allegory about the personalities changing in relation to the Reagan years. The novel closes at the end of an election cycle, which is interesting because the book was published 2 years before. In Evensong, of course, there are many character events and actions that are related to 1999.
That's right.
So it was with some delight and surprise to recognize within Mother Ravenel's confessional testimony on cassette that it's related to September 11th, right before September 11th. So I have to ask if you require a historical framework of some kind before you set out to write a novel, why you have these major events often tied in with your books, or essentially whether you may be, in fact, writing contemporary answers to historical fiction in some capacity. I'm wondering if you could elaborate on this.
Okay. I have to know when my characters are living and what they lived through. I don't start with the events. And in the case of Mother Ravenel, she's in an old folks home when it actually happens. But that morning she has been dictating her memoirs into a tape recorder. And they're very personal and emotional, and she's completely nonplussed when suddenly somebody in the old folks' home starts banging a gong. She says, "This is the wrong time for chapel."
Yeah.
So it's way out of her orbit. But then, in the next scene, she and another old nun are walking. And it happens to be in Boston where this retirement home is, and they're looking up at the skies, and the skies are utterly still.
Yeah. But I wonder if the historical setting helps you zero in on the internal impulses of your characters more so than, say, geography, although there is a good deal of architectural description of this. We can get into that, too. There's also a funny little Howard Roark joke as well. But I'm curious as to how time factors into what's going on inside, or whether this may also be part of the interesting joke in this book, that you can't tie everything to narrative. You can't tie life to narrative. Maybe you can elaborate upon how important a setting along these lines or a very strong sense of time is in relation to these characters' various motivations.
Mm-hmm. History, insofar as it affects their lives. For instance, in her memoirs, she's remembering the Depression, and the Depression is history, and it affected her because her father killed himself because he was not managing money well. So I try to keep it on the on the really personal level. Mm-hmm. I start with the character, but the character has to live in some time, and the character also has to live in a place. This book is very much about place, because I've been saving up this place to put characters in for most of my life.
Yeah.
But I just hadn't found the right story.
Yeah. I'm also curious about the Red Nun, which is very interesting on numerous levels. There are numerous Red Nuns. There's, in fact, three Red Nuns, possibly four. Mm-hmm. But I'll deal with
the fourth?
I suppose the actual narrative itself. But you have the play, The Red Nun, mm-hmm. that is authored by Mother Ravenel in 1931.
Right.
You have The Red Nun as this unfinished marble monument right outside Mount St. Gabriel's. Yes. And then we have a representation of that monument that is three-dimensional instead of just a painted backdrop within the play as presented in the course of the book. So you have this, what is a little bit different from your other books in the sense that one might even call it postmodernism to some degree, in the sense that we have a representation of a representation. I'm curious if the constant fixation on the Red Nun represents the search for trying to find an absolute narrative, or whether it merely is just the product of constantly trying to find symbols or the like where none really should exist, or there's the question of judgment, but I'll deal with that because there's a lot of issues in that question.
Okay. Well, I'll start by telling you, boohoo, that my novel was called The Red Nun,
uh-huh.
A Tale of Unfinished Desires, and it got all the way through the manuscript process, and then my publisher suggested that I might consider another title.
Yes.
Because there were a lot of people out there who might not buy the book if it had none in the title, because they remembered nuns hitting them with rulers, although I've never been hit with one. I think that was more for boys.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I've had several interviews with men who grew up going to Catholic schools, and they both were hit with rulers.
Yeah.
But we girls were never touched. And then, actually, the minute I decided I was going to write this book, The Red Nun came into my head, even before I knew what The Red Nun was. And that might have been because I was thinking of it as a ghost story. And one of my favorite ghost stories is Chekhov's The Black Monk. Then we also have the Blue Nun,
yeah.
the wine. But it was The Red Nun, and I did not know what it was for a while. I thought, what is this some ghost of a nun that floats around the halls, and when someone doesn't have a real vocation, she jumps out at them? And then I realized that it was not. It was an unfinished statue to a girl who did not get to complete her vocation, and her bereaved family had ordered white marble from Italy, and for some reason red marble showed up, and then the sculptor started on it and died, and so this wonderful thing was left, actually probably better than it would have been, because it's a 6-foot unfinished seated woman who has a lap, and the students often go and sit in the lap. It can hold two girls. And there is even a legend that if you're sorrowful, she will bend her body to your sorrow. So it worked out very well.
Yeah, yeah. But in terms of the representations of representations, I'm curious how that entered into the puzzle, so to speak. There's also one other aspect of narrative in this book. You have, for example, Maud Norton is working on this paper, the Downgrading of Dreams.
Oh,
it's
right.
a paper related to David Copperfield. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Henry Vick harbors some suspicions about Henry James. Numerous questions come into mind. Do you feel that way about Henry James? And did this concentration upon over-analyzing text, does it come from Ravenel's almost fairly austere demands upon the students that they are almost representing the Red Nun as a form of revolt or as a form of revenge, as we see the cycle of revenge carried out over the generation. But again, I'm sorry to have complicated matters here, but maybe we can talk about where the representation emerged from of the Red Nun in relation to this other concern you have going on through the book of the over-analysis of narrative as a sort of panacea to some degree to life, or as a sort of, you know, that everyone is a work in progress. In the life.
Okay, let's go back to Henry Vick.
Yeah.
Now he, what were we talking about with Henry Vick?
Well, Henry James, yeah.
Oh, yes. Well, Henry, this is a case of really being true to my character, because I love Henry James. And I'm rereading his very early tales right now just to see how he developed. But in the case of Henry Vick, who's a widower and has been in demand for a few years, one of his disappointed women told him that he reminded her of a Henry James character, the one in The Beast in the Jungle, the man to whom nothing happens. And then I reread that tale because I wanted to read it being Henry Vick. I wanted to be Henry Vick reading The Beast in the Jungle. And from his point of view, as I read it, it did indeed backtrack on itself. And as Henry Vick says, I believe he says, it was like trying to find an entrance to a building. And you
revolving could, door, yeah.
A revolving door. It just kept, he's an architect. So now what was the rest of that?
Well, the rest of it was representation versus overanalyzing text, Maude Norton's paper, the downgrading of dreams and all that.
It's really easy to get into all the things something can mean. This started off that the whole class in Unfinished Desires is reading David Copperfield. And then I wanted to see what these students would do with David Copperfield. And it naturally, you all of them related it to their own lives. And in Maude's case, she comes from a background that embarrasses her aspirations, and so she identifies with what she calls the downgrading of dreams, which David Copperfield did overcome, as did Charles Dickens.
Yeah.
It's a bit like playing with something, and the more you play with it, the more aspects it presents to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious where the punishment that Ravenel ekes out in relation to a sanitary pad came from. The idea of having to research the inner workings of a modern toilet. Was this based off of any of the interviews that you did, or
no,
just...
No, this was made up. When I was in Ravenel's head, in her character, I was being the headmistress, and she, as headmistress, with a lot of boarders, especially these boarders from Cuba, where the fathers really want them to be treated like young queens. This is back in before Castro. And when this girl keeps flushing things down the toilet and stopping it up, Mother Ravenel first thinks, well, I'll have her, as a punishment, clean the toilet stalls. And then she realizes, as a canny headmistress, that would not do, because these fathers just would not go for that, for their daughters to clean the toilet. So she had to think of something that would take a lot of work and be instructive. And so she thought, well, I'll have her diagram the workings of a toilet.
Yeah.
And I looked in books to see what this poor girl would have to do. And it's complex.
Wow.
So you had to actually, just to be fair to the characters, you actually had to consider taking on the punishment yourself.
Yes, and I and this girl would not have had these books that I have that give you, you can get books now that give you pictures of anything.
Yeah.
So you just look up toilet and there it is with in color with all the parts and full page labeled.
Yeah,
but to take this conversation further down the toilet, I should point out that that here we have a situation in which a biological budding occurs, mm-hmm. and the answer, Ravenel's answer, is to essentially deconstruct something that doesn't even relate to it.
Oh.
But the suggestion here, apparently subconscious based off of your surprise, it would seem to me to indicate, well, maybe you should just accept the fact that girls go through this and maybe come to terms with this instead of constantly having to have them deconstruct. Mm-hmm. Going back to the downgrading of dreams, this relates to that, because Maude's visceral reaction. She's asked to emotionally explain it.
Yeah.
And then she's asked to consistently dissect that emotional reaction. So we have a juxtaposition here, and I'm curious as to how that factored into the toilet incident, and over the course of the book, maybe you could talk about that.
Well, tell me, if you had been Mother Ravenel, what would you have thought of for the punishment that would not have been deconstruction?
No, I don't think so. I mean,
what would it have been? I mean, would it have been to talk about blossoming some more?
I would have talked to be honest about these kinds of things. That would be my get true to the heart, which would be my solution. But then I'm not really a religious man, so.
And you're not.
I'm a man too. So.
And you're not. Yeah, you're not a headmistress, a nun in the 1950s.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, did I haven't answered some part of your many faceted question?
We were really talking about like the visceral response of accepting people without judgment, because judgment is a factor in this, versus this deconstruction of both a classic text like David Copperfield, or in the case that we're discussing here, a modern toilet. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious as to how that juxtaposition, whether. I mean, it crops up very frequently in this book, and I'm curious as to...
I think I'm probably a calculating person and a calculating author.
Yeah.
And maybe I should think more about what a visceral response would be. Maybe, and I'll think about that in the book I'm writing now.
Huh.
I'll do that.
Yeah.
Visceral.
Well, visceral, yeah.
Yeah, all right.
But... Actually, similarly, if we're talking about, there's something I've observed in your books that I think is really interesting. For your third-person books, very often you devote these paragraphs where you get inside a character's head, and those paragraphs are devoted to nothing but that first-person introspection.
Right.
I'm curious how this arose and why there's this separation between just complete submergence into a character's head versus this more descriptive narrative, the narrative needs, rather. It's not just description, but I'm curious when that emerged.
Between the character and the character's inner workings and what's going on outside?
Yes, so you got it.
Oh, I'd much rather be inside.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my kind of book. I don't know if you've read any of my other books. Are there some that that have more of the visceral, that's go from outer event to outer event?
You know, let's pinpoint the visceral, because what you also do is you're very good at the telling gesture, the gesture that indicates some additional history. I think, for example, of the sexuality that's explored in Father Melancholy's Daughter, where it's extremely muted, and you let the reader judge what's going on. There's a moment where there's a father who is at the party that Maud observes, and she points out that, he was like a certain way at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, sometimes earlier. So we know immediately, he's probably drinking. And so I'm curious as to how that level of inference...
That's in this book.
It is in this book.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, two different
ways.
A
lot of fathers in my books drink.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What of also the capacity of traffic accidents, death by traffic accidents? Margaret's mother in Father Melancholy's Daughter. In this, Beatrix's mother, I believe, Tildy's aunt. That's right.
Uh-huh.
What of the preoccupation with death by car?
Well, there's not a. There are many ways to die, and those just happen to be by car.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of other. Some of them die of cancer.
Yeah.
Some of them. In one case, in this book, somebody trips over a silver tray and hits his head on the terrace and dies.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's necessarily just traffic accidents.
Oh no, I wasn't suggesting that. I just was suggesting that there's a frequency of people who die by vehicle collision. Which
I have to remember in my next book, I will not have anyone die.
Oh no, please feel free.
maybe I have too many.
Do you worry about repeating certain themes, particularly when you're doing a major world building like you do in this book of Mount St. Gabriel, where we really know the interiors of the 80 bedroom Victorian and the like? Do you worry about repeating, or is this something that really you shouldn't worry about? It's just inevitably you're going to repeat certain motifs and the like.
I think inevitably, being myself, there are going to be themes that get played and replayed in different keys, and but no, I don't worry too much about it.
Yeah. I'm also curious about the emergence of the adoption plot. What's interesting about that to me is that it comes up, and it's this compulsively readable plot that you're just completely fascinated by. You want to know how it's going to work out with Henry Vick and this creepy guy, Rex Wright.
Mm-hmm.
And then it suddenly stops, and we're suddenly back to Mount St. Gabriel. And we're there to take in what's going on in this school. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if that decision on your part was deliberate, that you wanted to remind the reader, look, here's a gripping narrative, but ultimately mm-hmm. what you're intended to do with this book mm-hmm. is to just open up your eyes and see what's going on in the sort of day-to-day life. Or maybe mm-hmm. Ravenel is meant to do that. I'm curious mm-hmm. about how much of that was designed, whether this was a subconscious scenario.
Well, again, I was in the character, and the character this time is Chloe,
yeah.
who has just lost her mother. And she does go to Mount St. Gabriel, and she lives with her uncle, Henry. And the way that part ends is that she goes down and confronts her stepfather and makes it very unattractive for him to pursue the matter anymore. And it is a ghost story planted in the middle, because she is haunted by her mother, and she feels her mother is telling her how to get him to go away and leave her alone, and she does it very well.
Yeah. Well, there's also this fixation, for example, Agnes, Chloe's mother, mm-hmm. Chloe discovers her tombstone and finds that her maiden name has disappeared. There's also the interesting character, the grandfather, granddaddy Tilden,
mm-hmm.
who knows the sources of all the counties, the names behind those counties yeah. in the state. The suggestion here is that there is some pivotal portion of the past that is inevitably doomed to be lost, or is going to be subject to the same revisionist memory that Ravenel yeah. is giving with her cassette confessions.
That's a very good point. That's yeah. good.
I guess the question here is, were there additional details that you held back from the reader? You mentioned your descent into the punishment with the toilet, mm-hmm. and I'm curious how much you concocted that was essentially not given to the reader in this book.
Oh, a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, the book was originally 900 pages.
Oh, wow.
And because I did enjoy writing it, and I did enjoy immersing myself in it. And so while you've got one student's paper about David Copperfield, in my first draft I did all 15 students.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I just breezed over it. Had their teacher is looking through these papers, but you see what each girl chose to write and how that fit with her personality. And I, talking about the grandfather who knows the counties, I went through the map of North Carolina and found out why each county was named the way it was, and you know, two are named for Indian, Cherokees and Catawba, and who those people were that the others are named after. But then I had to condense that, because this is something that a 16-year-old is telling a 14-year-old on a trip down the mountain.
Yeah.
So I had to make it, but I like to know the whole thing.
Yeah. So you need to know the whole thing in advance, and then you whack down. Is this generally the process for all of your books?
Pretty much. There's a lot more than goes in it,
yeah.
in the final manuscript. And I also draw pictures.
Oh.
If check my website, Gail's Art, I think it's called. Gail's Drawings. And look under the Red Nun, and you'll see all these drawings that I did while I was writing it, because it helps me find out things through images that I would not find out just through thinking and through writing words.
Yeah. Well, you were dealing with 15 students
yep.
as various papers. Why was Maud the one that stuck out the most out of all those 15?
Well, because the three main girls in the book are Maud, Chloe, and Tildy.
Yeah.
And Maud very much needs to find some way to explain her her compromised situation. So I thought it would be, Dickens was perfect for her.
Yeah. I'm curious, again, going back to this process of just whacking this 900-page draft down, going back to Father Melancholy's Daughter and Evensong, was this one of the motivations for Evensong, that there was a humongous draft of Father Melancholy's Daughter of little details that you couldn't?
No, it was different. I finished Father Melancholy's Daughter, and I thought that was it. Yeah. And I wrote another book. I think it was The Good Husband, which yeah. was a completely different subject. And then I thought I wanted to write a book about a religious retreat that took place right before the turn of the millennium. And I had started that book. I started that book about the religious retreat at the turn of the millennium. And then I thought, now I have to decide who's going to be at this retreat. And I was deciding I'll have some priests and some monks and some... and then I thought, I'm going to have Margaret Gower come back because I miss her,
yeah.
You know, Father Melancholy's daughter. And then I thought, and she's a priest now. She became a priest. And then I started making notes about her, and I thought, I want to write about her now. I want to write about her and her life as a priest and her life as a wife. And so the other book was ditched, or you might say it was like an eggshell, and then this new egg came out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems to me that you need to have an almost total concentration to build such a grand world. Find yourself getting distracted in any capacity when going through this process, or is it just complete and utter foci in work?
Well, in the last, I would say the last 10 years, I've been alone, and I live in the country, and I live a very quiet life. It's almost like a convent life, and I have great gobs of concentration available to me, and that's what I've come to love and to need. And so when I'm writing, I'm doing very little else except, you know, shopping in the afternoon and going and working out at the gym and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But when I'm writing, it's quiet, and I can go right down into that depth.
Well, Gail, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Wait here for the flag to fall and follow me to the edge of town. Your family's seen you on your bar. All they say is it's such a waste of time.